on the topic of environmental economics. Today we receive an honor from Dr. Benoît Planck. Dr. Benoît Planck holds a PhD degree in environmental economics from Queen's University, Kingston, Canada. He has 15 years of intensive work on the environmental policy, environmental economics, and at this moment he is also work as an international consultant for the fiscal policy office of the Ministry of Finance in helping us in designing the economics instrument for environmental taxation in Thailand. Today, Professor Laplanc will present a paper on a comparative analysis of the impacts of sea level rise in developing countries, particularly for the case of the Southeast Asia countries. So I would like to invite Dr. Laplanc to present what he'd like to say for this afternoon session. Please.
Can we close this light? Very good. Thank you. Thank you, Khun Sakon. This is a relatively small group, so if you have any questions at any point in time, you can ask questions instead of waiting at the end. I'm going to report about a research we did that was sponsored by the research group at the World Bank. And it's about assessing the impact of sea level rise in developing countries. Of course, there's been many research recently about global warming and about sea level rise. But so far there has been some research about trying to identify the impact of sea level rise. Some countries have worked very hard on these issues. Netherlands, for example, because Netherlands sea level rise is a big problem for Netherlands. But there has not been a study that have looked at developing countries and then trying to identify a common set of impact indicators and try to compare that set of indicators for all developing countries and trying to understand which developing countries in the world will have problems with sea level rise and how do we measure problems. So that's what we've tried to do. So what I'll try to do quickly is going through these topics. First, a short history of global warming, then the link between global warming and sea level rise, and sometimes that link is not well understood by people. Then the indicators we have developed, and then we'll talk about the results, the global results, and then looking a bit more closely in Southeast Asia and in Thailand also, and then some concluding remarks. So a short history of global warming, and people have looked at, analyzed the issue of warming on Earth for quite a long time. John Tyndall was the first one to identify what we now call the natural greenhouse effect, without which there wouldn't be any life on Earth. So Tyndall was doing models, and he was asking, well, according to his model, the Earth should have been a lot colder than what it was, and he was always wondering, well, what's going on here? And my model predicts a very cold Earth, and it's in fact warmer. So he's the first one to have identified that, well, there might be something, there has to be something in the atmosphere that actually traps the heat. Otherwise, it would be a lot colder than what it is now. So he identified this greenhouse effect. Now, Arrhenius went a bit further, and that's more than 100 years ago. He won the Nobel Prize in 1903. And Arrhenius, a Swedish fellow, he asked 100 years ago the same sort of question that people are asking today. The question he asked is, what would happen to temperature on Earth if a carbon dioxide concentration were to double? That's exactly the sort of questions that people today try to that people are asking with supercomputers. He was asking that sort of question, and what he found, according to his model, which of course was pen and paper, he found that, well, if carbon dioxide concentration were to double, temperature on Earth would increase by about 3 to 5 degrees Fahrenheit, 2 to 4 degrees Celsius, something in that order. And I say, well, I mean, supercomputers today, that's not so far from what they're predicting. Now, living in Sweden, when Arrhenius announced that result, people were quite happy in Sweden. If you live in Sweden, 3 or 4 degrees increase is quite a good news. So Arrhenius said, no, don't go crazy. It's going to take about 3,000 years before this happens. He was right with the 3 to 5 degrees increase. He was quite wrong with the 3,000 years. Charles Keeling, this is called the Keeling curve. Charles Keeling, since 1957, I believe, the first time he went on top of a volcano in the Hawaii Island, and he was going there every fall and every spring. And he to take measures of carbon dioxide, he was going to Hawaii to be as far as possible from any sources of emissions and capture concentration in the atmosphere. So that's called the Keeling curve. So what we see is two things: it's going up. It's been going up when he was there for about 40 years, and it's going like this. It's because in the springtime, when there is vegetation growth in the north, then that absorbs carbon dioxide. So every spring, the measure goes down, and it goes up, it goes down, it goes up. But the trend is really up. So that's called the Keeling curve in memory of Charles Keeling. This is called the hockey stick, more famous in Canada than in Thailand. The hockey stick is carbon dioxide concentration for the last 1,000 years or so. And the hockey stick is because on the last 200 years, since the Industrial Revolution started in the 1800, at the end of the 1800, carbon dioxide concentration has been going up quite steadily. It stands at about 400 parts per million now. The big question is that this red line at the end of the graph there is where is it going? Yeah. So there's a lot of people working on these models, business as usual scenarios and various sorts of control scenarios. We are now at 400, 385, 400. Where does it go? Where do we go from now? Yeah. The latest results under the business as usual scenario. Business as usual means business as usual, no additional effort to control. Global emissions are expected to increase from the existing 7 to about 10 billion metric tons per year, and then to 14 billion tons per year by 2050. So carbon dioxide concentration would double compared to the beginning of the century, the last century, by 2050. So that's about 200 years time span, which is only 2,800 years before Arrhenius predicted. So Arrhenius was right on one ground; he was quite wrong on another ground. When I present that to my students, I always say, "Hence the danger of linear extrapolation from the past. If you extrapolate from the past in a linear way." You end up with 3,000 years. It's going, we know the dangers of doing that, and that's a clear illustration of the danger of linear extrapolation. What's the link between carbon dioxide and warming? There's a pine in California, in the White Mountains of California. This is the pine, and this is me not holding the pine, but simply touching it. This pine, any idea, Kotsakon? Yeah, it's me. Yeah. How old is this pine? This pine. Any idea how old is this pine tree? Over 1,000 years. Over 1,000 years. That could be 2 million. No, this tree in particular is approximately 3,500 years old. The oldest bristlecone pine is 3,800 years old, and it's not identified in the park. So you know that there's a tree out there which is the oldest living thing on earth. Yeah. But it's not identified because the park doesn't want people to go and take branches and all that kind of. You would imagine people doing all sort of thing with that tree. So it's not identified. But this one is close to that. The reason why I'm showing this is because of this tree, we know very, very, very precisely for the last 300 and 500 years, the carbon content in the atmosphere and the temperature in each and every year of the last 3,500 years, because the ring tells you how warm it was, and the content of that ring tells you about the carbon content in the atmosphere for each of those years. So it's a phenomenal measure that we have. But one might say 3,500 years, or it's a lot for this tree, but it's not a lot on the history of Earth. So what we have is Antarctica, where we can go back in ice. We can go back about a million years. Yeah? So for this measure here, this graph goes back 400,000 years ago. And again, for each and every year of the last 400,000 years, we know exactly what was the carbon dioxide concentration in the atmosphere and the temperature in that year. Yeah? So people that talk about uncertainty, to a large extent, it's nonsense. I mean, we know. So what you have there, the upper graph is the carbon dioxide concentration, and the lower graph is the temperature. So take your eyes, go from up to down and from left to right. And the correlation between carbon dioxide and temperature is now, of course, as a good economist, we know that correlation is not causation. There's a difference between the two, but at least the degree of correlation between the two is very, very high. So now the key question is, as CO2 concentration increases there at the end, what happens to temperature? Now that's sort of key issues that people are dealing with. What happens with temperature? This is an ice core. So this is an ice. They dig in the ice in the Antarctica. They dig in the ice. They get. I think the core is something like 5 kilometers long. Yeah. And for every year, what you have is compacted ice, which is snow falling. And then snow falling on top of the snow, and snow falling on top of the snow. So the snow that fell 100,000 years ago is still there. Now it's compacted, but there's many meters of snow on top of it. But it's still there. You can actually identify it and measure the content of that ice. Yeah, they call that carat. Yeah. Not quite sure why carat, but So scientists can measure very precisely this sort of thing. Yeah, yeah. So the latest prediction is 2 to 5 degrees Celsius increase by the end of this century. The key result, well, whether it's 2 or 5 or 6 or 1 or 3 or 4, the key result is that it's happening a lot faster than people expected 10 years ago. So all the recent wave of scientific papers, they're all unanimous. It's happening a lot faster than people thought. And the reason for that is what's called positive feedback or domino theory. You might remember, no, you're probably too young to remember that, but the gentleman at the back and things are gone here. You might remember the domino theory, the domino theory, which said during the 1960s that if Vietnam falls to the communists, then Laos and Thailand and then Malaysia and everyone will fall. It's a little bit of the same thing. There's three contributors to this domino factor. The first one is called the albedo effect. The albedo effect or coefficient, it's a ratio. It's the quantity of light reflected relative to the quantity of light incoming. So a very, very pure white surface reflects all the light. It absorbs no light at all. So it has an albedo coefficient of 1. A pure black surface has an albedo of 0. A pure black surface absorbs all the lights that it gets. So what's happening when ice melts? We're replacing a physical matter which has a very good albedo coefficient reflecting the light. We're replacing that with water, which has a very low albedo coefficient. Yeah? So what's happening is the ice melts, so more and more light and heat gets trapped by the earth. Well, the more light and heat gets trapped, the more ice melts. The more ice melts, the more heat gets trapped. But that's positive feedback loop that's happening. The second one is, and that's a big, big concern, is the permafrost. Permafrost in Siberia and Canada, to a large extent. The estimate is about 450 billion tons of carbon dioxide equivalent, it's mainly methane, in the permafrost. So what's happening is the permafrost right now is thawing. Yeah? So the permafrost is thawing, not melting, but thawing. It's becoming soft, not frozen anymore. Yeah? So when the permafrost thaws, it releases the methane. Well, methane is a greenhouse gas. The more methane it releases, the more impact it has on global warming. The warmer it might get. The warmer it gets, the more the permafrost thaws. The more it thaws, the more methane it releases. So that loop like this is creating problems. Not so far from Montreal now, I mean, where the use of planes used to land on permafrost to provide food supply to people living very, very, very far from anyone. These planes used to land on permafrost. They cannot anymore. It's too soft. You know, so they have to build runways for those small airplanes. Trucks, big trucks, because we have in Quebec, we have in northern Canada, we have a lot of hydropower plants, both in operation and being under construction. Trucks used to drive on permafrost. No need for roads. Yeah, permafrost is like this. Yeah. Well, they cannot anymore. It's too soft. So the big problem created, if you want to think about cost and benefit, there's a big problem created by that. And finally, we have the oceans. The ocean is a big unknown in terms of the relationship between ocean behavior and global warming. So far, thanks to the ocean, about half of all the carbon that we have produced has been absorbed by the ocean. Yeah, so that's thanks to the ocean. However, the ocean is getting warmer, and as it gets warmer, it releases that carbon. Yeah? So again, what's happening is the ocean is getting warmer, it releases the carbon. The carbon will have impact on global warming. It's getting warmer. The warmer it gets, the warmer the oceans will get. The warmer the oceans will get, the more carbon it will release. Yeah? So that's. And that sort of phenomenon is not something that is going to stop very easily or very quickly. And this is there's a lot of energy built into constructing those loops. And once the loops are in motion, going the other way is not something that is going to happen very easily. It's going to take tens of thousands of years before the energy in that loop is sufficient enough to stop the process. Yeah. And that's an important message. I'll come back to this. Okay, so what's the link between warming and sea level rise? there's two things, and one thing that is very, 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 very important to understand, because it will be important when we conclude, and the sort of message that we make to policymakers, is most of the sea level rise, almost all of the sea level rise that people predict in the next 100, 150 years, has very little to do with ice melting. It simply has to do with the ocean getting warmer. And as the ocean gets warmer, it expands. Yeah? So for the next 200 years or so, sea level rise is going to happen that you want it or not. It has nothing to do with our current emissions of greenhouse gases. Yeah? And that's very, very, very important when we think about, okay, so what do we do now? Yeah? We'll come back to this. Yeah? That's very, very, very important. Of course, ice melting will contribute later on to this. But at this point, it has to do with thermal expansion, not ice melting. Yeah? And again, that we like it or not, it is going to happen. We are committed to a sea level rise of about a meter within the next 100 to 150 years or so. We are committed, meaning it is going to happen. Yeah. So, and that's important to remember that. Now, about ice melting, one thing here is Greenland and Antarctica are the key problems. The Arctic ice cap is not a problem. The Arctic ice cap is ice floating in the ocean already. So when it ice melts, when the Arctic ocean melts, it's bad for the albedo effect, but it doesn't do anything to sea level rise because the Arctic Ocean is already floating. Yeah? But Greenland and Antarctica, it is ice on land. So when it melts, the water goes in the ocean. Yeah? So that's the problem. Now, Greenland is about four times larger than Thailand, and most of it is covered with ice. It's 8% of the world freshwater supply. If it were to melt, sea level rise would be about seven meters. And the thing is, it is melting. And the thing is, it is melting a lot faster than people thought 10 or 15 years ago. Yeah, a lot faster. Yeah, so some kind of image on the glaciers on Greenland are retreating. Yeah, and they're retreating a lot faster than what people thought. And that's the important message in the last 10 years of scientific literature. Antarctica, 14 million square kilometer. If Antarctica were a country, how large would it be compared to other country that we know? Any idea? That would be larger than Singapore, that's for sure. Antarctica would be the second largest country in the world, just behind Russia. And the reason why you are surprised, or perhaps you didn't know, it's because when we show this kind of map, Antarctica does not appear. Where is Antarctica? Yeah, Antarctica is at the bottom there. So, but it never shows up in those maps that we use. The only place where it shows up is if you have, you know, a globe. And then you see it at the bottom. It covers the entire bottom of the Earth. Yeah, but on this kind of flat map that we normally have in our offices or at home or wherever, Antarctica does not exist. It's not on the map. Yeah, and that's what people sometimes don't know. But when it would be the second largest country, much larger than Canada, and just behind Russia, and it's covered with ice. Yeah. There's two ice sheets of concern. The Amundsen Sea is very much of concern, and the West Antarctica ice sheet. Larsen B there, there were satellites that captured the collapse of Larsen B. Larsen B collapsed in about 6 weeks in 2002. From left to right, you see there this ice sheet collapsing. It was about 200 meter thick and about 3,000 square kilometers. It's a bit difficult when you see these pictures to try to understand how big it is. 3,200 square kilometers, it's about 5 times the size of Singapore. So that's about 5 times of Singapore collapsing. It's about, I checked this morning, it's about 3 times the size of Samutprakan, and it's about 2 times the size of Bangkok. So imagine 2 times the size of Bangkok, 200 meter thick of ice just collapsing. Yeah, it's gone. The Amundsen Sea is ice of 3 kilometers thick. For me, I can't imagine that. I come from a country of ice and snow. For you, I'm not sure if you can imagine something 3 kilometers thick of ice. What's happening with the Amundsen Sea, it's anchored at the bottom. So imagine this thing, it falls a cliff, and then it goes at the bottom of the ocean, and it stays there because it's anchored at the bottom. Yeah. What the scientists are afraid is that it might just slip from the Antarctica continent. Yeah. Can just slip and become like an iceberg if you want. Yeah. So the Amundsen Sea does not have to melt. It simply has to slide in the ocean. And if it were to do that, sea level would rise by a meter. And indications are not good. It is breaking off from Antarctica itself, from the land mass itself. I'm not quite sure, actually. That's a good point. I'm not sure. I've always thought of warming. I'm not sure about volcanic or underground activities having an impact on whether or not the Amundsen Sea would collapse. I'm not sure. It could be. I don't know. Yeah. But that's really a concern. That's really a concern. Yeah. Okay. Again, the latest scientific result is Antarctica is losing ice, and is losing ice a lot faster than people expected. The measurements right now are very, very, very good. The problem with the Arctic is the albedo that we're losing, this albedo coefficient we're losing. It's not about sea level rise, per se. You know, imagine there's a cube of ice in my glass here. As the cube of ice melts, my glass does not overflow. Yeah, that's the case of the Arctic Ocean. Yeah. Okay, you've heard about the fourth assessment report, perhaps, by the IPCC. It was published in April, I believe, 2007. So their predictions and findings, or I would say agreements, negotiated agreements, is something between 30 and 80 centimeters increase by the end of this century, and then a meter by 2050. That's something like that people are talking about in terms of sea level rise. Well, what's important about the IPCC is, in terms of literature review, they stopped the literature review in 2005, and since 2005 there's been a lot of new research being published, new results, and all of those results show actually this is happening a lot faster than thought, and then reported in the IPCC fourth assessment reports. One thing of concern as well is these storms, because there's a link between storms and sea level rise, as we all know. The evidence about storms right now, what people say is, because of global warming, there's in the last 100 years or so, there's not a larger number of storms, all categories put together. So the number of storms has not changed, but there's a lot more stronger storms today than there was before. So you have less of the category 1 and 2 storms and a lot more of the category 4 and 5 storms. So the number in aggregate has not changed, but we have stronger storms than before. So I'm not going to talk about storms, and we've tried to model that. It's very difficult to model the impact of storms on land and population impacted and so on and so forth. It depends on the intensity of the storm, and it also depends where the storms is coming from exactly. How does it hit land? So it's a difficult exercise. It's not more frequent. Despite what it seems, you know, as we read the papers and look at TV, it seems that there's a storm every 2 days. No, there's not more storms, but there's more stronger storms and less weak storms. Okay, so what we did in this research is we've constructed 6 indicators of impact on land population, urban extent, agricultural extent, GDP, and wetlands. And we've constructed 1 to 5 meter sea level rise. This is the sort of scenarios you find in the literature. So, I mean, 5 meters is not going to happen tomorrow. But that's the sort of scenarios that people have looked at. So, well, we may as well take the same sort of scenario. So what we have is, I don't remember the number of countries, 80-something developing countries, those with coastline, of course. Lao PDI is not in the analysis. those with coastline. And we say, well, what happens to these 6 indicators as sea level rises? So it's, I mean, technically, it's an easy exercise. It takes a lot of time. And you need quite powerful computers to do this sort of work. Because the Earth, according to the latest elevation data, the entire Earth is divided in little square of 90 meters by 90 meters. So that's many millions of squares. And in each of these squares with different databases, I'm not going to talk about each of these databases, in each of these little square, you know how many people there is, what sort of urban activities is taking place, agricultural activities, and then you can go on to GDP, and there's database about wetlands as well. And so you can superimpose these things, and then you just raise by 1 meter how many of those pixels get flooded, how many people in those pixels, which GDP in those pixels, and so on and so forth. So that's the sort of exercise, roughly, sort of an exercise we did. Working at the World Bank, or it helps to do this kind of exercise, because you might imagine the World Bank has access to the best data sets to do this kind of work, and does. So we had access to phenomenal database for each of these indicators. Okay, so what do we have? Let's look first at quickly at global results. People like things like top 10. So let's do a top 10 winners or losers. I'm not sure. It's probably losers in this case. Number one, any idea? Most impacted country? Maldives? No, actually. No, that's true. I should have said. We didn't include island countries because they're going to disappear. So there's no point. I mean, the problem with Maldives is not what do we do now. The problem with Maldives is where do we go? And in fact, I believe Australia has said, okay, yeah, they're going to take the people of the Maldives, as citizens of Australia, And Maldives is going to disappear. That's clear. The top one, I mean, the first one is Vietnam. Vietnam is going to be hit very, 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 very hard by a 1 meter and then sea level rise. So this is impact on population. What you have on the left is in percentage of the existing population. So it's about 11% of Vietnam's population would be impacted by a 1 meter sea level rise. Impacted means you have to move. 11% of Vietnam population has to move. Now, you don't see Thailand in the top 10, but think that there are 10 million Vietnamese that have to move. There's not a lot of space in Vietnam to move. Population, GDP, Vietnam, urban extent, Vietnam. I'm going to show you why that is, and there's a good reason for these results. Agricultural extent, Egypt. That's a 1 meter sea level rise, yeah? So it's nothing that people don't expect. We are committed to a 1 meter sea level rise in the next 150 years. This is going to happen. There's no question about this. Yeah. So the issue with Egypt, of course, is the Nile Delta. This is a satellite picture of the Nile and then the Nile Delta. This is where Egypt grows its food. So this is a zoom on the Nile Delta. So this is what's going to happen to the Nile Delta as we increase sea level rise by 1 meter. 2, 3, 4, and 5. This is where Egypt grows its food. Say, right, so what do we do now? Yeah. And I think that's the key issue, it's the key message that we will reach in the concluding remarks. I mean, the problem of Egypt is not greenhouse gas emissions and reducing its greenhouse. The problem is this. Is what do we do with this? Egypt's greenhouse gas emissions is nothing. The problem is this. It's the same issue with Thailand. I'm going to show you a picture of Thailand. It's the same issue with Thailand. Yeah. This is at the very top there. This is Alexandria. Now, 7 or 8 years ago, the government of Egypt took a loan from the World Bank, a $150 million loan, from the World Bank to restore the artifacts of Alexandria. Alexandria was a very important city in the old time. You've heard perhaps of the Library of Alexandria. So it's very, very important. Yeah? And the government of Egypt invested money in Alexandria to protect it for tourism purposes mainly. Now this is what's going to happen to Alexandria as sea level rise. I think the key question is, and that's sort of question that developing countries and Thailand should ask itself, is put yourself in the shoes of the government of Egypt and Alexandria, the authorities at Alexandria, show them these results, and then ask them the question, now, do you take a $150 million loan to restore the artifacts of Alexandria? The answer perhaps is no. The answer might be, we're going to use that loan to prevent this from happening, or bye-bye Alexandria, and we're not going to invest money in restoring and painting or whatever they do to restore the artifacts of Alexandria. It's the same sort of scenario in Thailand. At the Gulf, the states around the Gulf, Bangkok, Chonburi, Rayong, are going to be impacted very, very hard by sea level rise. I'm going to show you that. Okay. Now, is it wise to have a policy of industrialization along the Gulf? You're going to have to invest billions of dollars then to protect that infrastructure from sea level rise. Is that a wise thing to do? Yeah. Let's look at Southeast Asia. This is for each country. Land impacted in percentage of the country. Yeah. So we're all looking for Thailand. It's here. This is Thailand. Look again at Vietnam. Vietnam is oh, it's so tough. It's going to be tough for the Vietnamese. If you look at China over there, China is very, very small in percentage of its land mass, but that's because China has a big land mass. If you look in absolute term, in terms of square kilometers, China is most impacted. So China does have the largest amount in absolute term, the largest quantity of square kilometers flooded. As a percentage of its land, that's small, because it's a big inland country. Yeah. Vietnam, what's happening in Vietnam is every country that has deltas, river deltas, such as the Chao Phraya, is severely impacted by sea level rise. Now Vietnam has two deltas, the Red River Delta and the Mekong Delta in the south. Yeah. So that's 1 meters, 2, 3, 4, and 5. South in Vietnam, everything south of Ho Chi Minh City is gone. Yeah. And in the north, you have the Red River Delta. That hits very hard. That hits very, very, very hard. The Vietnamese will have a tough time with sea level rise. Now, what's the issue, of course, is 65% of industrial production in Vietnam is taking place south of Ho Chi Minh City. Not good news. Yeah, that's going to be very tough for the Vietnamese. The Vietnamese have big, big, big problems with sea level rise. Population. Thailand is still at the same place, third from last. Agricultural extent. Thailand is not impacted by sea level rise in terms of its agriculture. It's taking place in the north and northeast of Thailand, so that's not going to be big impact. But look at what happened now. GDP. Urban extent and GDP. It creeps up. Now, when you talk about urban infrastructure and GDP, now Thailand starts to be hit quite severely by sea level rise. And the reason is, it's because sea level rise will have an impact in and around Bangkok. Yeah? And that we're talking about industrialization, we're talking about urban infrastructure, we're talking about GDP. And this is where the economic activity of Thailand is taking place. Yeah? And that's going to hit very, very hard by sea level rise, that area of Thailand. The question is, so what do we do? That's the key issue, really. I was in Beijing recently, and there was the lady deputy director of PCD. I forgot her name. We're going to meet her on Friday, but I forgot her name. Yeah. And you talk to PCD, and she was there, and I gave this talk, and then you talk to PCD people, Pollution Control Department, and in the Ministry of Environment, and sea level rise and Ministry of Environment, that's something they haven't worked on. That's something that they don't really know anything about. Yeah? But this is happening. Yeah, this is happening.
Economic prosperity centered around.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. And that's the question I was asking before, is if you know that, then I think the key issue for developing countries and a key issue for Thailand is, okay, how do we use that knowledge? Yeah, how do we use that knowledge to plan future economic development and in particular infrastructure? Yeah. So, and fortunately, sea level rise, it's not going to happen next week. But it is going to happen in the next 150 years, slowly. Yeah. So, how do we use that knowledge to prepare ourselves so as to minimize the impact and the cost of this sea level rise happening? I mean, that's the key issue that is being faced. You know, Thailand does not have a problem with greenhouse gas emissions. Thailand should invest $0 in reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It should invest money into adapting. And so this is going to happen. What do we do now, and how to prepare ourselves now to minimize the cost of sea level rise? There's other issue, mind you, I'm talking about sea level rise. There's also drought patterns are going to change, and there's a number of other issues associated with global warming. I'm talking only about sea level rise. Yeah? So one might argue that it's more important to look at the north and northeast Thailand because rain patterns are going to change. Than southern Thailand where sea level rise is going on. Do you put your money there or you put your money here? So that's different sort of issues. So I'm talking only about sea level rise now. The economic is quite clear. There's a number of studies that have been done. Stabilizing emissions would cost about 1% of GDP, the world GDP, per year for the next 50 years or so. If we don't do nothing, damages are estimated between, or depending on the studies, between 3% and something like 10 to 20%, depending on which studies you read. The difference between Nordhaus and Stern Review is it's good to use with our students that don't quite believe or understand the concept of discount rate. The difference between Nordhaus and Stern is the discount rate they use. Yeah, so technically their results are the same, but they're using different discount rate. So one may have a debate about what's the appropriate discount rate to use. But in both cases, I think what's important is if you do a cost-benefit analysis, stabilizing emissions is a good project. Yeah, that's something, whether it's 3% or 5 or 20, is greater than 1%. Yeah, so stabilizing emissions is a good project. Yeah. As I've mentioned before, people don't know this most of the time, and it's very difficult to understand and perhaps to accept. There is nothing we can do about sea level rise. Put that in your head. There's nothing we can do about sea level rise. It is going to happen. By at least a meter, and the next by the end of the century, if we're not lucky, up to the next 200 years, if we are a little bit more lucky. But it is going to happen. Yeah, it has nothing to do with our current emissions of greenhouse gases. It has nothing to do with that. It's simply, right now, the atmosphere is warmer than the ocean, and for the next 200 years or so, the ocean is going to absorb that heat to reestablish the equilibrium between air and ocean temperature, and as it does that, it expands. It has nothing to do, or very little to do, about ice melting. Ice melting, it's only ice on the cake. Yeah, it's only additional to that. Yeah, and that's very, 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 very important to understand, because you cannot enter into a scenario where you're going to say, let's not invest in adapting. Let's not try to protect ourselves. Maybe it's not going to happen. Maybe if we're just lucky a little bit. There's no question. It is going to happen. The question is, what do we do when we know that? Yeah, that's really the key issue. Yeah. Now, if you still believe that, perhaps if we can stabilize greenhouse gas emissions, maybe sea level rise is not going to happen. Well, greenhouse gas emissions are not going to stabilize anytime soon to any level that we would be comfortable with. Greenhouse gas emissions have been going up despite any kind of protocol that you might think of. It has been going up for the last 200 years, including the last 10 years. and it will continue to go up for the next foreseeable future. Greenhouse gases will not stabilize anytime soon and surely will not go down. Yeah? I feel like I'm bringing good news to your department today. Now, some people say, well, with the current prices of oil being, you know, increased so much, you know, it was $60 a barrel 2 years ago. It's now 94 or something like that. Yes, 96 today. Maybe, you know, oil consumption will increase as a result of that. And so maybe, you know, people will look at substitutes. Well, that's partly correct. But what has happened in the last 4 or 5 years? The price of palm oil and biofuels has doubled in the last 3 years. The price of uranium, which potentially, albeit controversial, but potentially substitute for coal-fired power plant, has increased sevenfold in the last 7 years. And the price of silicon used to do solar cells has increased three times in the last 2 years. Yeah. So the economics of oil has not changed a lot despite the recent increase in the price of oil. If you do comparative analysis for oil and other sources of energy, yes, the price of oil has increased, but so has the price of substitutes. Yeah? So this to say that we're not going to observe a quick and significant shift away from oil and coal towards less carbon-intensive sort of energy production. That's not going to happen anytime soon. The consumption of oil is going to continue to increase for the next 30 years. The consumption of coal is going to increase for the next 30 years. Yeah. So, if you think about stabilizing greenhouse gas emissions, it's not within our lifetime. Not mine. Not yours. Maybe yours. Some people, not within our lifetime. It's not going to happen anytime soon. Yeah. So, sea level rise is going to happen. It's going to happen faster than we thought, and probably more than 1 meter than what we are currently predicting. Yeah. So for developing countries and for Thailand also, the key question is, how do we adapt to this? Well, sea level rise is going to happen. How do we adapt to this? And apart from countries, and maybe United States, in the developing world, apart from China, to some extent India, the question is not about reducing greenhouse gases. That's not the question. I mean, I give this sort of talk to the Vietnamese, and I say, should we reduce our greenhouse gases? No. Your problem is not greenhouse gases. Your problem is you have 10% of your people that are going that have to move. So what do you do? How do you minimize that number? Yeah. And if you don't want to minimize that number, where do they go? What are alternative strategies? Yeah. And importantly, I think at this point is, as we plan our economic development, how do we take that information into account? Let's plan, especially infrastructure development. Let's plan those infrastructure in such a way that they won't be impacted by sea level rise. We won't have to invest hundreds of millions of dollars to protect the infrastructure that we're building, including cities. Yeah? I think that's key. There's not a whole lot of effort in that kind of work at this point. Yeah? We've shown that sea level rise in Thailand, it's a few percent of land, a few percent of population, and so on and so forth. Now, a few percent at the national level, it seems small, but for those people there, it's 100% of what they have. Yeah. So some areas of Thailand along the coast, mainly on the Gulf side, not on the Andaman Sea side, but on the Gulf side, are going to be very, very impacted by sea level rise. And the question is, so what do we do? Do we slowly move them, or do not allow, declare zones, no development zones, because you know that these zones will be impacted by sea level rise, so that slowly and gradually you push development away, without forcing anyone, you just declare zones where development is not allowed, so that development is taking place elsewhere. Do you think about moving infrastructure away? That's a costly strategy. In terms of planning, where do you plan future development? All of this sort of thing would go into some sort of a adaptation strategy, a national adaptation program, into which the Minister of Environment has never thought about, as far as I know, in Thailand. Yeah. And I think that's really the key message that I wanted to do here. With this presentation is let's think very, very seriously about adaptation and about preparing ourselves so that the cost of adapting, waiting is going to be a very, very, very costly strategy. So let's again, there is time. It's not going to happen next week, so there is time to do this work properly. With scientists, with economists. I think economists have some comparative advantage in a few things, thinking about trade-off and incentives and costs and benefit, and put in place a solid adaptation strategy which is going to protect Thailand against major cost. Yeah. So that's what I wanted to say.
Thank you very much, Benoit. You never fail me. Every time I listen to your presentation, I really enjoy it. And this time you scare me too, not just that. Okay, I think now the floor is open for everyone who might have a question. Please, Ajahn Sukhum.
Okay, I think your presentation is very interesting. I think it has created attention and also fear. What will happen in the next 150 years? But that fear might be overrided by the time span that who will live in the next 150 years. So I wonder if it would be more beneficial to project this type of sea level rise in terms of time period, say what will happen next 10 years, so that it could draw more attention, rather than say at sea level 1 meter, 2 meter, 3 meters. Can we translate into time, say, okay, in the next 10 years, what would happen to the sea level rise, and then next 20 years, and so on, so that attention and adaptation can be taken into account to cope with each period of time, rather than to cope with say 1 meter sea level rise? Is that possible?
With the sort of work that we've done across 87 countries, no, you cannot do it. The data sets available does not allow you to do that. In terms of sea level rise, in order to see that in your computer, it works by chunks of 1 meter. Even half a meter you cannot do. But you could do that if you want to say, okay, now that we know, let's say, the situation in Thailand, can we get more precise estimates, as you mentioned, in terms of centimeters instead of meters, and in terms of identifying precisely where it's going to go? Then you could do that, but you would need to do that. You would need your own sort of database, if it exists. I would think that some ministry somewhere might have the data necessary to do this kind of work. So the database that we have used would not allow you to do that. No, they're too macro in a sense, macro being 90 meters by 90 meters, which is, you know, quite nice resolution when you work worldwide. But if you want to do that for specific areas of Thailand, for example, you will need a better database than that. And the international database does not allow to do that. You will need to develop your own, or maybe it already exists. You know? But once, I think, during this sort of crude maps that I've shown you for Thailand, you could do much better maps than what I've shown you. More like those that I've shown you about Egypt, for example. This could be done with Thailand. I'm sure there's the resources and the capacity to do that, and the data to do that as well. So when you look at the area around Bangkok, when you look at the area in the south around Songkhla, this is where it's going to happen. So you could focus there and say, okay, let's analyze more precisely. Perhaps in the context of preparing an adaptation plan, what's going on there, and what's in the next 10 years, 20 years, 50 years, what's going to happen? Yeah, that would be the next step.
I think your research would call for attention to really, try to collect information, okay, relevant to this issue, so that more detailed action can be taken. Okay, here is rather crude and very macro, of course. But I think for case of Thai people, I don't think they have that long vision to pay much attention to something that will happen in the long run. I think Thais are very pragmatic. They are interested in short run. They are not interested in long run. That's why in Thailand, if you talk about environmental problem, they are not at the top of the list.
May I add a little comment here, because as Ajahn Sukhum mentioned, that this type of the information has been floated around in the around the global. I don't think every country know that. But how come, if you look at from the news or the television broadcast about the impact of the global warming and so on, mostly it's really few mention anything about the sea level rising. They more focus on the carbon dioxide emission rather than on the sea level. How come this thing happen, because without this kind of projection in future, the preparation or the policy from the government might be misleading.
Most of the debate or the discussion about global warming comes from developed countries. It is fueled by NGOs from the West, yeah? And the agenda is about reducing greenhouse gases. Yeah? But if you are south of the equator and on the east side instead of the west side, it's a different picture. It's a different picture completely. The concerns are completely different. And should be completely different. I think the debate is completely misplaced insofar as developing countries are concerned. Completely, yeah.
No, I think your methodology could be very useful for, say, like Samut Prakan province. Because each year, this sea level rise is a problem for a certain period of the year. And I think it must have changed for the degree of the sea level rise. But if the provincial authority does not start to collect information about this and observe, these changes, I think maybe it would be more severe in the future. So I think this kind of study could, lead to more attention by the provincial authority to start collecting this information, and then may use the same methodology to analyze the impact,
I'm not sure that the provincial authorities would have the expertise to do that. It's probably, at the national level. But about your first comment about Thais having a short-term horizon, I don't think that's specific to Thai people. I think it's the common. This is why we have discount rate of 2 or 3%.
You see, if you talk about most Thais, they are not urban based. You're talking about Thai farmers. They are very pragmatic. 되려면.
Thailand is going to be severely, I mean, northeast Thailand and this entire rice production area, and according to models about rain pattern and drought pattern, is going to have a big, big impact there as well. In this research, we talk about sea level rise, but there's impacts that go beyond and of different nature than sea level rise. For most African countries, the issue is not sea level rise. The issue is rain and water. Yeah.
In more aggregate term, like natural disasters, it seems that in aggregate, these natural disasters have been taking place, you know, more frequently now. But of course, like you say, that the kind of frequency of storm has not really changed, only the severity of it and so on. Yeah, but you know, nowadays there's been some changes created by men, the construction of dam and so on, you know, that changing the environment, that also has some impact on the environment. Right, you know. So I wonder if there's any way that we could really trace the impact of this, the changing of the nature. Okay, sea level rise is one aspect, but there can be other as well, you know, that will affect the quality of life of human being as a whole.
I normally don't think in big terms like that. I don't know what it means when you start thinking about big terms. I like really micro issues that I can understand and then target. Yeah.
Anyone? From the students, you can ask in Thai or in Laos. You can speak Lao. Mm-hmm. Anyone?
Legitimacy is different than economic rationality. So I'm not sure I can say anything about legitimacy. Canada now, for example, is investing hundreds of millions of dollars in controlling greenhouse gases. Canada is producing approximately 1.2% of greenhouse gas emissions, world greenhouse gas emissions. And so when I go to Canada, I say, well, why are you using my taxes to reduce greenhouse gas emissions? Does it make sense? There's the issues of legitimacy. There's the issue of reputation. There's the issue of if we do it, maybe then we will have a stronger voice at the table to induce the Americans and the Chinese to reduce that. You know, there's that sort of spillover reputation sort of effect that Canada may have by investing in greenhouse gas reductions. Would Thailand have this kind of increased bargaining, negotiation, reputation, authority by investing this time? I don't think so. In the context where there's, you know, this is economics, and in the context where there is available a finite and limited amount of resources, the question is, what do you do with those resources? And where should they be invested or used? And that would bring the highest possible benefit. I cannot think of any other way. But that's because of my background. But and that's the only question to ask, really. And then you say, okay, we have 1 billion baht. Do we invest that in installing all the coal-fired power plant or natural gas plants with some kind of carbon trapping technologies, or do we start thinking about, you know, adapting as opposed to reducing? adapting to sea level rise or other problem? It seems to me that the answer is very clear. Now, of course, trapping carbon dioxide, for example, also means you're trapping other gases which do have local effects, not global effects. So people talk about ancillary benefits associated with controlling greenhouse gases, sulfur dioxide, for example. And people in China, there's been a lot of work that maybe the Chinese would invest in carbon dioxide sequestration techniques, not because of the carbon dioxide, but because in doing that, they also trap other gases, and mainly sulfur dioxide, which does have local impact. So if you look only at the ancillary benefits, they justify such investment. You don't need to look at the carbon dioxide and the global impact. So there is that. But purely from a global perspective, then the issue is not that. The issue is really how do we adapt. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I wonder if you have brought your study to the Netherlands. What would be the result?
Well, Netherlands is it's a big problem, of course. I mean, Netherlands is going to be covered. No, I did not. We did not do that to Netherlands or other developed countries. Our focus was developing countries. Netherlands, they're. And to be frank, they don't need our estimates. They have much better estimates than whatever we could produce. So right now, Netherlands, their strategy, it's quite an interesting strategy, and they're doing that right now. Is instead of blocking the sea, and we imagine a wall, though it doesn't quite look like a wall, but instead of blocking the sea, their strategy is to make space inland, to make space for sea to come. Yeah? So they're building big canals and areas where sea will be coming, and thus not flooding other areas on Netherlands. It's a very interesting strategy that they're putting in place. No, they're sure they're doing that, but their strategy is not a wall or dike sort of strategies. No, that's quite interesting. Well, New Orleans, the problem was not sea level rise, it was a storm. The New Orleans strategy was a wall. It didn't work. But that, I think that was an engineering problem. So the question is, okay, for the Gulf of Siam and all the areas around the Gulf, do we adopt a let-in strategy, or do we adopt a wall strategy? I mean, all of these questions, I think, are important to ask and say, okay, let's study the situation and let's see what works, what doesn't work. And sea level rise now is happening regularly in the Gulf, and the way that Bangkok is dealing with this is taking the water from the north, releasing that water to make sure that salted water does not come and intrude into the fresh water of the groundwater of Bangkok. Okay, so it is working now. Well, the problem is, of course, there's less and less water in the north to do that. So there's conflict north and south with the proper use of that water. And if it is, even if there were enough water in the next 100 years to pursue a strategy of flooding the south with water, will it continue to work as sea level rise increases? People talk about the perfect storm for Bangkok. So imagine a 1 meter sea level rise and imagine a tropical storm at the same time. It's going to hit hard.
Anyone else have any questions or like to share your idea and comments for what we are discussing? Anyone? Please.
10%, I don't know. I cannot answer that question, I don't know. But ice is melting. Will continue to melt if temperature increases. But again, it's not in the next 200 years or so. It's not going to have. It's not going to be the key contributor to sea level rise. No. No. Yeah. Oh, I'm sure it will have other sorts of impacts, but not on sea. Not on ice. Not on ice, no. No. It is melting, but you know, it takes a lot. No, not in the next 200 years, no. That would be a lot of ice melting. Where the ice is melting now mainly is in Asia, on the Himalayas. And the problem now that it's doing, that's a different kind of problem. It gives a sense of security to Southeast Asia that there's a lot of water actually flowing down from the Himalayas. And that's because the ice is melting. So it gives a sense of security that, oh, no problem, there's a lot of water. But that's because the ice is melting. And within 200 years or so, the Himalayas are not going to be covered by ice as they are now. So where then is the water going to come from? But this sense of security is postponing action, is postponing, let's think about this seriously. In the United States, I'm a hiker, as you saw perhaps in the picture, I go hiking a lot. They say that in the next 20 years, there will be no more glaciers in any national park in the United States outside Alaska. Gone. Melting. Yeah. It's gone. Yeah. If you want to see ice on the Kilimanjaro, go soon. It's going. 20 years. People say 20 years and it's going to be gone. Kilimanjaro, yeah. Well, yeah. Very soon. Yeah. Which one? I don't know that one. In Hawaii? I don't know that one. In Hawaii? Yeah. Oh, I've never been to Hawaii. Maybe one day.
In your paper, you mentioned that the West Antarctic ice sheet could collapse into and fly into the sea, the ocean. Yes, and it can cause SLR of 5 or 6 meters. How likely is that, and how soon it can happen? Could you guess?
No, I'm perhaps not the right person. I'm an economist, not a geologist or whatever sort of scientist like this. No, people are not saying that that the West Antarctic ice sheet is going to collapse soon. But people are asking questions about that, and they are concerned about that. So they keep following that very, very closely. So I think no one really knows when it is going to happen, whether it is going to happen, maybe it's not going to happen. So people don't know that, and that's why they're studying the situation. It's like, when is the volcano going to explode? We don't know. So it's this sort of situation that with the Amundsen Sea, the concern is it doesn't have to melt. It just has to slide in the ocean. Yeah, it's as if, imagine I were to put a cube of ice in my water, the ice doesn't have to melt. It just have to go in the glass.
Is it a worst case scenario for the SLR, for the West Antarctic Ice Sheet to slide? Is there anything worse than this for the sea level rise?
The worst case is Antarctica completely goes, and that people that I mean the estimate is that that's about a 70 meter sea level rise. If all of Antarctica go, but I mean all of Antarctica will not go, in the next 1,000 years. But that would be the worst case. I mean, perhaps the worst case would be unexpectedly, the Amundsen Sea collapse tomorrow, and then the day after, or there's a 1 meter sea level rise. That's catastrophe. That's catastrophe. I mean, people are talking about the concept of environmental refugees. People that have to move because the environmental conditions or the ecosystem does not support life anymore. That's the sort of situation. That's the sort of situation that that Vietnamese would find themselves in the next 100 years or so. Yeah. Now you've noted, perhaps you have not noted, all the results I've presented. They are in percentage terms. Yeah, that's right. We didn't present the results in absolute terms, how many people, 11 million people, or that sort of absolute figures. And the reason for that is, in order to present statistics in terms of number of people, then you need to make projections about population growth and so on and so forth, and about urbanization rates. And so on and so forth. So we presented figures in percentage terms, but I mean, if you think in absolute terms, it's always a danger because people adapt as things are changing. Right now, if sea level rise were to happen in Vietnam, 1 meter, it's about 11 million people. Yeah, have to move now. Now, if that happens in 100 years from now, that's potentially a lot more people than 11 million, for sure. But then, you cannot really do that because as sea level is increasing, people are not going to adopt the same patterns of location and urbanization that they would adapt otherwise. I mean, sea level rise is not happening all of a sudden. Yeah? So it's always a bit difficult to do these extrapolation like this. That's why we didn't do that. So we don't have figures. We have percentage impact. I mean, land is fine. Land is not going to change. But population and GDP and urban extent and agricultural extent, that's a bit more dangerous to make this kind of predictions.
Anyone else? I have a thing to ask you. In your presentation, you talk about the rising of the oil price, and now it's about $86 a barrel per barrel. And you say that by rising of the oil price is not triggered for the change of the technology. Then what would happen? And that means we going to continue using the oil like this, and nothing going to happen in the near future.
In the near future, no, nothing going to happen. Mm-hmm. We're stuck with it. there's a number of issues with oil prices. One, if you look at this 96 or something like that level, it's not clear what is due to speculation and what is due to structural shifts in demand and supply. Don't quite know. We know demand is going up, but trying to distinguish these two is quite difficult. I mean, if you assume away any war in Iraq and then problems with Iran and then the Turkey problem, and if you assume away all of that, then what happens to the price of oil? Well, it drops. It drops to which level? don't know. In terms of substitute, what sort of ideas that people in Congress in the United States are talking about is we don't want the price of oil to fall too low. If it falls too low, then any substitute, it won't happen. Yeah? So people are talking about, let's make sure that the price of oil, if ever it were going to fall, that it doesn't fall below $50 a barrel. And then if the world price of oil were to fall below $50, then it would be replaced by a tax, so that the market price will never be below 50. Yeah? So if the world price were to be, let's say, 45, then a tax of five, an American tax of $5 would be introduced. And the purpose of that is to try to give some certainty about expected benefits in investing in alternative and substitutes. Yeah, because the substitutes are dead when the price of oil reaches $40 a barrel, as it was in the last 20 years. Yeah, there's no substitute is viable at that price. Now, the slide I've shown you before is on uranium and biofuels and all these things. The prices of these things have gone up tremendously. But you might think that this is perhaps a short-term impact on the substitute because they were not able yet to catch up with the increased demand for their products. Yeah? And that as they invest into biofuels and other technologies, wind and solar, that the prices of these substitutes in relative terms is going to go down. You would expect that to happen. There's some sort of excess demand for those technologies and the price went up. So there's probably some rooms for adjustment there, but the issue is it's going to take time. The consumption of oil and coal is not going to stabilize at today's level in the next 50 years. It's not going to happen like this. Yeah? So if you think about stabilizing greenhouse gases, forget about this.
What you are saying is suggest that the Thai government has the wrong policy in our energy policy, on our energy policy. Because of our Thai government, Thai government. But it implies that seems to be that we are stuck with the high price of the oil, right?
But let me share with this. I think in case of oil, people talk about leaving the market forces to function. I think that seems not very right to me, because we are dealing with the case where there's an imperfect market on the supply side. There's a monopoly on the supply side. But of course, the demand can fluctuate a lot. But there is no response from the supply side. The quantity of supply of oil is controlled by OPEC. You know, and to me, I think that the way that price of oil could fall, it's just that, you could not really encourage more competition on the supply side. And you know, when price of oil falls, in fact, in economics, when you talk about speculation, in fact, it could be a stabilizing factor. But it happens that it may lead to the, even a higher price of oil because of speculation, that people could make profit out of this speculation at the expense of the consumers of oil, So I'm sure that the potential substitutions of oil are available now. But it may not be commercialized at this price of oil, $96 and so on. But what is wrong if, say, price of oil falls to $50? Of course, you say that it will not encourage the introduction of any potential substitutes for oil. But then of course, if that is the result of the market mechanism, it will be fine, because there will be the adjustment of the demand and supply. But it seems to me that now the demand fluctuates, but the supply seem to be fixed.
There's many things. It is true to say, I mean, the current U.S. administration has said many, many times that, you know, let market forces work. And they say, well, I mean, how do you deal with a cartel then? That's a problem. But I mean, supply has increased in the last few years. Supplies of crude oil has increased. The problem now, at least in the United States, and I said being a key market, the problem is not the supply of crude oil. The problem is a limited capacity to refine the oil. There's not enough refineries in the United States. There hasn't been a new refinery in the United States in the last 30 years. And that's where the glut is. So the oil is coming. The crude oil is coming, but it's not being refined because there's no capacity to refine that oil, and that drives all prices up. And that's a key issue. The issue of substitute. I mean, substitute will happen at some point, you know, and at some price, it will happen. But so I don't want to suggest that. The market for substitute is non-existent, and as you've said, substitutes are available. We know how to do different types of different sources of energy. We also know how to do carbon sequestration from coal-fired power plant. But the economics of all these things is such that, and that's the only thing that I think that we're pretty sure of is, we are not going to observe a significant shift away from carbon sources of energy anytime soon. And that what that means is, get ready.
It seems to imply that it does not pay to expand the oil refinery facilities. What is the reason for that?
What is that?
Is that, you know, you say that there's no expansion of the oil refinery facilities in the U.S. But the inflow of crude oil is not a problem.
Yeah, that's right.
Then the question is that, why so? Is it because the return on investment on oil refinery facilities is very low, or what?
I don't know. I suppose.
Or it needs a very large initial capital investment.
The initial capital investment is tens of billions of dollars.
Mm-hmm.
I suppose that up to a certain point, there was enough capacity to handle. They're working at 94-95% capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And then demand increases, and at some point, you need to invest. You need to, and that sort of investment. I mean, that market is far from being perfect.
Mm-hmm.
At some point, you find yourself in that sort of situation.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that the American government is doing now, and so is the Thai government, to a smaller extent, is you know, subsidizing biofuels and ethanol and all of these things. And you say, generally, when the government has tried to pick a winner, it has chosen the wrong winner. And I would say choosing a technology, biofuel, and subsidizing like hell that technology to make it financially viable is generally not a good approach.
That is what I tried to say.
Okay.
Okay. Are there any other questions? Anyone? One, two, three. Okay. Thank you very much, Benoit. As I say that every time I listen to your presentation, I learn a new thing all day, all the time. Okay? And on behalf of the Faculty of Economics at Thammasat University, I would like to say thank you very much for your being here. I know that your schedule is really busy, and it's very fortunate for us to have the opportunity for you to share the idea, share your knowledge with us. Thank you very much. And I think the faculty have some small token to show our appreciation for you. Wait for them. Okay, so I would like to ask Ajahn Sukhum on behalf of the faculty to give this token to Dr. Bernola Prang.
เสร็จแล้วค่ะพี่อุ้ยหนึ่งไปไหนหนึ่งจะ
ไ
ม่ไม่ถึงจะเอาตัวฟังเสียงหนึ่งเข้าไปไว้ตรงไหนอ่ะอ๋อเห็นแล้วพี่